But she doesn't tell stories.
They actually wasted an awful lot of time writing to the king about that, as a matter of fact. It was pretty dull in St. Augustine, and anything they could find to complain about was important.
Oh, it's hot in here. Mm-hmm.
I'll turn on the air conditioner.
This
is a well-kept secret. It's the only air-conditioned room at the festival.
Your secret's out, I know it. All morning, so this is very cool compared to where I've been.
Okay, now I know where to come when I have to put on that wool. When I put on that wool outfit, I'll know where to come.
You don't know where to come? Are you all storytellers?
No, we're just here to listen.
Well, very good.
I've been telling them, everybody has stories that they can tell.
I bet you've told one this week without realizing it. This is what I tell the children. You don't realize it, but if someone fell down, you wouldn't just say if she fell down. You go into great detail of how it happened.
Right.
And that's the story. I mean, you continually, and you relate knowledge from one person to the other, and that's the story.
Sure. You sit down, you stop and tell your daughter, or your daughter says, do you remember old Aunt so-and-so? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah. So, do you remember how she used to do this, or remember how she used to look? And you're telling stories about the family right then.
And this is what is so great about storytelling, because you just...
I was just going to say, this is terrific, because I'm supposed to introduce everybody and get everything started, and I said, a storytelling workshop?
No.
They'll start without me.
We'll never even notice.
Great.
Storytellers are generally people that like to talk.
Yeah. It's a good workshop, because I don't know everybody here. My name is Peggy. And I know Peggy,
yeah,
and Pat, and John.
And
Sam.
Margaret.
Maddie. What's your name?
Tony.
Johnny.
And I'm Margie.
So, as Pat has already said, we've got some people on the program as storytellers, but everybody has a story to tell. And I'm working with the Florida Folklife Program, who's putting on the festival here. We're really happy to have everybody here, performers and audience. And in a workshop area, this is where the performers and the audience meld together. We don't have performers, we don't have an audience, and everybody can feel free to put in any kind of comments or anything you want to. And as a folklorist, I feel the storytelling workshops are one of the most important things that go on at the festival here. It's not as visible and as crowd drawing as that main stage out there, which is more more of a thing that people immediately notice and go out towards, or the crafts. But the storytelling is something that everybody has in their life. It's part of everybody's folk life. And there are several different types of stories that are told. Not only that, when people think of storytelling, they think we're always going to tell, say, fairy tales or some kind of a tall tale, but it could be a personal experience story.
It's a lot more fun if you're talking about people you remember or things that you've seen.
That's right.
Sure.
And those are the most important things, because people don't think they're important to pass on, but those are what's going to go to our children and our grandchildren and from whatever. And so what I'm going to do is shut up now.
Yeah.
I've got my I've got my tape recorder running. I want to just keep everything, it's just going to run through the whole thing, and it's all going to be loose, and I'm going to let you, I know we have certain order on the program, but that's not going to be the case, which whoever wants to put in, I'm sure one story will lead to another.
Yeah, I'd like to get in a plug for history hard on the heels of what you just said, too, because that's my crusade, you know, and it's unfortunate that we're raised believing that history is only something that connects with dusty dates and people who sit in libraries and squint a lot or get cobwebs on their head or something. But watch your mouth. Okay, but if it's the same thing we were talking about a few minutes ago. I started to learning about history when I started talking to my mother and to my aunts and learning about my family, you know. And we used to get, that was the only way I got to know my grandparents, because they were dead. They were all dead before I was born. And if I hadn't heard those stories about the family, you know, and learned those things about them. My mother used to talk about Grandma Dove. Grandma Dove was a great-grandmother of mine. And I think about her all the time, because she had been alive during the war between the states. And I can see her all the time in my mind's eye, because the story was so vivid when my mother told it. When she was elderly in the end of the 19th century, she became a little bit senile, and she thought the war was still going on. And she would go out every afternoon and walk for several miles along dusty roads, putting chunks of bread on the fence posts for the soldiers who'd be coming back from the war. And they said for years that the grandsons would go out every afternoon and collect it so she wouldn't know that it wasn't still happening. Wouldn't know about it.
Oh,
isn't that neat though? And I think about her all the time. But you have stories like that too, I know, that you remember about your family.
She can't tell stories.
Yeah,
well, I was explaining to everybody, we went through this long, involved rap down the cooking thing.
Panic-stricken rap.
I can't go up there all by myself.
Well, you put my name on it, didn't put his, and I said, but I don't do a single act.
Well, listen, I'll tell you, it may have been just an oversight, and I'm sure.
No, because I'm on by myself Sunday, I think.
Yes, well. And I'm going to have to be running in and out since I'm, unfortunately, when you work at a festival, you never get time enough to just sit and relax. And
I know.
So I'll be running in and out to try to be in as much as I can because I love the storytelling more than anything.
Very good. Peggy, where's Jay today?
He's down listening to older.
That's why he's not here.
Yeah.
He's scheduling the two things at once.
Well, he's not coming. Well, he's just coming up here to be with me.
No, Larry Older?
Larry Older. Uh-huh.
He's supposed to be at this workshop.
Yeah, he'll probably come up here after he finishes.
Okay, good.
You're flexible.
Where are you folks from? Are you from Florida?
I'm from Denver.
Denver? How long have you lived in Florida?
I'm visiting from Florida.
Oh, okay. You're not from here either, right? You are?
Originally, but I've been living here for 32 years.
You were born in Florida?
Yeah.
They're getting harder to find.
I know. Rare species.
Are you from Florida too?
Yeah, retired now in Florida.
I'll be darned.
If Barbara Foster shows up, she's a sixth generation from
here.
Yeah,
that's right. And Patty's about
10th or 11th.
10th or 11th.
Yeah, somewhere
Right. Yeah. Are you from Florida?
My grandfather named the town I was born in.
Which was what?
Otter Creek.
Oh, really?
Otter Creek?
His name was Max.
Yeah.
George Maxwell. My mother was born there. And all the children, and when he married my grandmother, she was his second wife, and she was 16, and I guess he must have been about 50,
mm-hmm.
or 55, because he was about 85 when he died, and he died 1918, and he had collected a Civil War pension then since he was about 1915, I think. I have tax receipts that go back to show his first marriage, 1866, and his wife was the first postmaster there. Postmistress or whatever you call her, but they don't have his name in one of the history books that I have listed there, and they said somewhere that anybody who fought, you know, for the Confederacy were not eligible to vote, and the only people they counted heads for when they did the census was the people who didn't fight and who they considered good citizens.
Well, that
the other people had
year.
To be put on probation.
Are you still living in Otter Creek?
Yeah.
No, I don't live in Otter Creek. There's no Maxwells there now. Because when my Uncle Clarence died, he and my mother had feuded over the property for a number of years, and he had a heart attack discussing terms. And so he didn't see her for a number of years, but every time he got in the hospital with his heart condition, she would go to Gainesville and stay with my sister-in-law and go up in the lobby, and she was scared that if he saw her, he'd get upset. So she'd send my sister-in-law up and down and his wife to see him. And then she sold the property to my sister-in-law, and my first cousin's two children, he's dead, signed their property over to her as because they're her grandchildren. My in-law, more or less, and she had the whole business, and now she has sold the property, I don't know who, to, but the only Maxwell male that's living is living in England right now, from that bunch of Maxwells, and he's coming home in June. He was home last year, and it was the first time in 17 years that he had been home.
Well, whereabouts are you living now?
I live in Tampa now, but I lived in Gainesville. We lived in Cedar Keys. My stepdad was railroad man. And we lived in St. Petersburg, Tampa, Williston, Dunellen, Waldo, when the shops were there. And he drove the last train out of Cedar Keys in 1929 and to pull the tracks up behind it.
Yeah, did you know the Boothbys out there?
Yeah, I knew the Boothbys and the Hathcocks.
You know Bob Boothby?
Can't remember that
name. I worked
name.
With him over at the university.
Faces, I don't forget. First names, I don't remember.
They lived right next to the hotel.
When my stepdad was a young man, he went to Cedar Keys. And the little town that no longer exists now was a sawmill town right outside the limits. Was called Lukens. And he worked in a sawmill there in a cabinet factory. And that's how he learned how to do that before he went on the railroad, which is what his daddy did. And he did that for about 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when they drove that last train out of there in 1929, we had lived in Cedar Keys for a while then. And it was not that none of us like seafood, at least Mo and I don't. But we had it twice a day. It tastes good. But now, it doesn't. Now, my kid would be cold, so my sister would. But down there, it just tastes different. And we lived just nothing from the water. Our house was on about 8-foot pines. And I joined the church down there when I was about 8 years old, and they baptized me on Easter Sunday with a bunch of them right in front of the house at low tide. And you can imagine how we waded out there in fear in that muddy stuff with our feet, thinking we was going to step on a stingray or something at that low tide. But all went well. And then that big storm, hurricane, they had few while we was down there. And one time we came up to Grandma's at Otter Creek, which we did most weekends. And when we went back to Cedar Keys, all the bridges were out, of course. And we had to take a boat. And at that time, the Tarpon Springs sponge boats were there, you know. Mm-hmm. That's where they moved the headquarters to Tarpon Springs. And a sponge boat would meet the people and take them over. And when we got to our house, it had about 3 inches of water in it, and a sponge boat was tied to the porch.
Oh. I'll be darned. That's pretty good.
Washed away entirely.
St. Augustine got that bad one time. Now, that was, as a matter of fact, it was about the same time. It was in one of the big hurricanes in the 20s, and the streets flooded because St. Augustine is low, and it sits right between Matanzas Bay and the San Sebastian River, you know, and it doesn't take much for the city to flood if it gets bad. Some enterprising film company from New York brought gondolas down and set up cameras and filmed and used the big Pasqualian Hotel as a backdrop for Venice.
Well, I
floated gondolas down the street in St. Augustine.
I guess I've had my share of hurricanes and storms, because in Cedar Keys we got used to watching for the storm warnings, because we lived here and up on top of the hill. They had the storm warnings go from that hotel, you know, they hang the flags up there, and all we had to do was look up there and see what was coming. And as I grew older, I wasn't afraid of that kind of stuff. And
you have
through
to learn
traveling
to
around, in my early years, I was in a lot of storms and hurricanes and walk out in it, and it didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have been in New Orleans in a boat on Canal Street, and I have seen the water 3 feet deep in the basement of Charity Hospital.
Yeah.
By the same token, in 1950, when the eye settled at Cedar Keys, big hurricane, I sat at the crossroads there for 48 hours. With Dick Williams Amblets from Gainesville, the Red Cross man, and a few dozen others, waiting, because my grandma would not leave that house she lived in and go to the schoolhouse. And then there was a woman at the schoolhouse at Cedar Keys that broke her leg, and Dick Williams had an amphibious tank pull a brand new Cadillac ambulance down there.
Oh, for God's sake.
To get that woman out, and the Red Cross man's still down there debating whether or not he's going to call it a disaster. And every house in town at least had the roof blown off of it.
I remember that hurricane. Uh-huh. The city flooded in 1950 then, too, and I looked out on our back porch. I can remember the cats were all standing out on the back porch, and they all had their backs humped up and their hair standing up straight, and I thought, how odd that they'd get that upset just because the water was rising. And then I looked out a little further and realized there was a skunk up under the washstand. Scared the poor cats half to death.
Yeah. Well, they said there was not a house or a building in Cedar Keys that didn't at least have the roof blown off. The whole place
that was a bad one.
Had to be, and most of the people that didn't get their boats sunk, you know, they were destroyed. Yankee Town was hit also around the curve there, but the Red Cross didn't go down there. I hauled 4 or 5 loads of clothes down there to the schoolhouse and had people come up and get them from Gainesville. I worked at the hospital in Gainesville. I was giving anesthetics there. And everybody would, in the hospital, the doctors and all their families and all would bring me stuff. And I brought all those clothes down there and let those people get it because the Red Cross wouldn't do anything down there.
Have you folks ever lived through a hurricane?
I haven't.
You never even seen one, I'll bet, huh? No? Have you lived through a hurricane?
Yes.
Here in Florida?
Yes.
That's quite a scary thing, isn't it?
It's
So they say. I've been through it.
Didn't scare you the same bad time?
I was too young.
When was it?
Oh, I don't know, in the 40s, you know, 30s, 40s.
We had a really horrible one in 1935 in the state of Florida.
Yeah, I was here then. I lived here in 1934.
Okay, that was the one that destroyed the bridge across the Keys.
Right.
The railroad bridge, as a matter of fact. The 26 and the 28 mm-hmm. were the bad ones, though.
Well, I wasn't quite here at that time. I was born in 26.
Oh, really?
I was not here at the time of the storm.
Do you know that the worst damage that was done from the 1928 hurricane in Florida was drowning, flood damage, because the winds drove the water out of Lake Okeechobee and almost 2,000 people were drowned?
Was wiped off the mountain. Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's the third largest flood disaster in the history of the United States, behind the Johnstown and Galveston floods.
It's before they put the dikes.
Uh-huh. That was a horrible thing.
Well, in 1956, Hurricane Hazel hit mm-hmm. South Carolina, and that was really a bad one. I was teaching at the time, and school was out. I remember being at home and watching it on television. All the houses falling into the water, and there was a man, Mr. Saunders from Conway, South Carolina, who was out with his family at Pauly's Island.
Oh, wow.
For the last vacation before school got in full swing.
Pauly's Island.
He was walking along the beach and he happened to look at a man dressed in gray. Well, now he'd heard the story of the gray man. Maybe you've heard of it.
No.
He's, if you see him, you know there's going to be a disaster. It's a warning.
Oh, really?
And he really does exist.
Does he only walk on the coast of the Carolinas?
He's in Pauly's Island.
Pauly's Island.
That's it.
Pauly's Island's the only one.
Oh.
Well, Mr. Saunders turned to tell his wife about it, and when she turned to look, there was nothing there but a gray mist. Now, he grew up in Conway, and he'd heard this story, and he always, you know, poo-pooed it, what did he think? Well, he kind of laughed about it, but then they went home, got in the bed. At 2 o'clock in the morning, someone came banging at the door, and telling him that he had been sent. The man said, Mr. Saunders, I've been sent to warn you that Hurricane Hazel is going to hit tonight. Get your family and evacuate. Go to the shelter.
Oh, my God.
So he got a few things together and got in the car. And something was bothering him about the man. So he got in his car and started going to the shelter. And when he got there, he asked the Red Cross director, he said, who was the man that you sent to warn us to leave? He said, I'm sorry, Mr. Saunders, but we ran out of volunteers before we got to your part of the island.
Oh, great.
And he said, he got really thinking about that then. Well, after the hurricane passed, he got back in his car and went home. And when he drove up to his house, not one thing had been disturbed on the house. Nothing had been, not even a shingle was missing.
Oh my God.
And none of the clothes on the back porch were disturbed. Both houses on both sides were flat. Now he wrote for the News and Courier, and he was a reporter, and he wrote this as the truth. Now, the story of the gray man is, it goes back to right near the end of the Civil War. There was a young lieutenant who was coming back to Porter's Island. He was engaged to this doctor's store. Back in those days, if you could afford it, you would have a house at the beach because Charleston, South Carolina is hot in the summertime.
Sure,
you know.
That's right. You get out of Charleston when the fever's on.
At the beach, and they were going to have a big party to celebrate the engagement. The young lieutenant was riding home from the Confederate Army, of course, and his horse stumbled. He disappeared. They never did see him again. And the daughter moaned and couldn't eat, couldn't do anything. She was just on the verge of dying, really. But her daddy said, well, you've got to get away. She had her trunks packed. She was in the boat going out to the ship to go over to Europe. Her daddy wanted to get away. She turned around. And looking in the background, she saw someone on a sand dune motioning for her to come back. And she had the boatman turn around and go back. And just as she got out on the land, the ship sank. And she looked up, and he was gone. And she declared that was the gray man. But since that time, many people have seen the gray man. I have been to Pauly's Island many, many times. I have looked. But I have never seen the gray man. But if you ever go to Porter's Island, keep a lookout. If you see a man dressed in gray, you'll know something is going to happen.
Now, I know that I was partly raised around Charleston. That's where my mother's people are from. I've heard that story.
Isn't it true? He really
that is what, that is what my grandmother would call a soul story.
Yes.
That story is so.
Is so.
So, yes.
Very good.
But I have an uncle who, I think he's writing for the Journal now, but he was wrote for the News and Courier. He's a pretty well-known local historian on the Lowcountry. He's got a bunch of stories that he has written that he says after his death will be published. And I asked him, well, why wait until you die? He said, because if we publish them before I die, he said, I won't live a week.
But he's, that's for sure.
But he's an expert. He is an expert and does guest lectures on the taverns and body houses of old Charleston.
Oh,
well, Charleston's been around for a long time.
Well, I bet he does know some neat stories.
I was up there a couple of years ago.
Too, a seaport.
Yeah. Yeah,
I was up there a couple of years ago, and we went up on vacation, and he took my wife. She's a Yankee. She's from Pennsylvania. Took her around and showed her around the town. Said, now, you talk about old houses. He said, I'm going to take you and show you some old houses. He said, we don't start talking old, and we're talking 17th century.
Sure.
And she's like, well, my parents' house is old. He says, oh, when was it built? She says, oh, just before the Civil War. He says, it's not old.
Oh, Charlestonians are very proud of that.
Oh,
yeah, they're different. Breed
altogether from anyone else. Mm-hmm. But I had, my mother's people are from around Charleston, actually from McClellanville, which is about halfway between Boston and Georgetown. And my Uncle John was recorded by the South Carolina Historical Society telling some of his stories, which I can't tell because he told them in Gullah dialect.
Oh,
now,
when I was a little kid,
I could speak it. I can speak it. I still understand, but can't speak it. Yeah.
These are dialects from what they call the Low Country, the tidal areas
of
the Carolinas.
What happened when that country was first settled? Of course, everyone kept slaves in the plantations. The average slave could not survive in that area, so they hired a ship's captain and told him to go to Africa and find a coastal area that resembled the Charleston area. And get slaves from there, and the ones that he came back with were the Gullahs. And the language, the English that they spoke and still speak, is called Gullah.
Then where's Geechee come from?
That's a derogatory term.
Oh, sorry.
But instead of saying palm, they said Pam. And for years, there was a place near Charleston called Pama Bridges. It's not, it's Palmer Bridges. It's Palmer Bridges. But he said he was out on Santee River one time. He was going out visiting someone and said he came on this little shanty down by the river and said there was an old colored woman sitting there. And the door said she was eating fish and rice mixed together and spitting out the bones at a great rate. And that on her lap next to her was sitting this little kitten. It looked like he'd like to have some fish and rice too, and said, just as he came abreast of her, the kitten kind of motioned with one paw, and she looked down and she said, Kitley, you want to see the face of God, you put your hand in my vittles. That's about all the gullah that I get.
We got kind of far afield there. We ought to come back to Florida.
Well, we can come back to Florida because when we were little, I don't know if you've heard it or if my grandmother just made it up, but when we were little, and Buddy and me, not my sister and my brother, because they're so much younger than we are, but they would want to say something, and they'd say, where lang, we you lang, go lang, or we lang, go lang, et lang, they lang, slee lang, you know. And
well, that's double talk.
Well, whatever it is, it's just got a lang on the end of it, and they used to do that with us as kids, and we just thought we were so smart when we got old enough to catch on.